Welcome to Cannabis House Call. This podcast is committed to educating the discerning public and will make the case for cannabis as medicine. Your hosts, Dr. Les Matthews and Dr. Hal Altman, are physicians with advanced degrees in medical cannabis. The Cannabis House Call is sponsored by Compassionate Certification Centers, or CCC. CCC is a physician-owned and leading medical marijuana certification center that helps patients receive legal access to medical marijuana in Pennsylvania. Having certified more than 100,000 patients across the state through its in-office and virtual telehealth appointments, CCC makes the process of getting a Pennsylvania medical marijuana card fast and easy. Learn more at cccregister.com.
Hello, and welcome back to Cannabis House Call. My name is Dr. Les Matthews, and I am one of the principals on this production, along with my colleague, Dr. Hal Altman, who joins me today. Getting back into the subject of cannabis as a medicine, we felt it was important to begin to provide some insight and education into some of the basic physiologic aspects of cannabis and how it affects us as humans. And I think you'll be fascinated to learn some of the history of these discoveries and how truly recent they are. To set the stage, if you think about it, our bodies are basically a compilation of a number of systems. So, for example, we have the cardiovascular system, the heart and blood vessels. We have the neurological system, the brain and peripheral nerves. We have the gastrointestinal system for our GI tract, and so on. What's interesting, and what was not well understood until only about 25 years ago, is that we also have an endocannabinoid system within our bodies, which has a very important role in maintaining a lot of important bodily and mental functions. So we thought it would be important to give our listening audience some insight into what we know about the endocannabinoid system and how it affects the way cannabis interacts with us as human beings and how it can impact us as a medicine. So Hal, would you walk us through a little of the discovery history around the endocannabinoid system? It's a fascinating story, I think.
Sure, Les. And I think we should make it clear that the discovery, our discovery of the endocannabinoid system really was the sort of primary move for me, at least, to understand that cannabis could be treated as a medicine. And neither of us ever knew about the endocannabinoid system until we jumped into our studies. I think it legitimizes the potential effects of all cannabinoids, and it is basic for our understanding. So I think that we run the risk of boring some of our listeners with some of the science and technological information that we may impart, but it's extremely important, and hopefully we can make it interesting.
Just don't bore me, Hal, please.
No, never, never less. So just to take us back a little bit, we talked at one of our past podcasts about the history of cannabis as medicine and the fact that it's been around for 5,000 years. And the irony is that we really didn't understand its potential as medicine, the science of that, until about 1964. It was the last 60 years, really, that have allowed us to be able to discover the endocannabinoid system and to project how we think that its components affect our health. And I think just to get a couple definitions out of the way so that we don't confuse anybody, we're going to talk a little bit about homeostasis. Les, what's your understanding of homeostasis?
In medical terms, homeostasis refers to a balance between two or more systems within the body. For example, in a homeostatic environment, our heart rate equals our blood pressure equals our ability to do exercise, things of that nature. So there's an integration of systems that work together to provide a common result, if you will.
I think that's a great definition. It's basically a governor that exists so that when there's an imbalance, that there is an action that's taken and the system that's sort of out of whack comes back into balance. Another word that we're going to use a lot of times is cannabinoid. And cannabinoids technically relate to the cannabis plant, the compounds that are found in that cannabis plant. There are over 100 cannabinoids in cannabis, and they are all somewhat related chemically to THC, but functionally are much different. And there are two classes of cannabinoids that we'll talk about. The one is phytocannabinoid. That phyto means plant, and that refers to the cannabis plant. Endocannabinoid refers to the endogenous system that we're going to spend time talking about today. That is cannabis-like products that are made within the body.
So Hal, let me interrupt you for a minute, because I think this is striking and important for the listeners to understand that the human body manufactures cannabinoids.
Yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So all of us have the ability and really the need to have our bodies produce cannabinoid structures that, again, contribute to this homeostasis that we alluded to earlier. And I think for us and for many, that revelation was shocking. I didn't understand it. I didn't know it. We didn't learn about it in medical school. And I think it's a very important point to emphasize.
Yes. Let's just talk a little bit about what we've learned in the last 60 or 80 years concerning the endocannabinoid system. And then we'll talk about the specific components of the system and maybe talk a little bit about the functions and the way this works as a homeostatic overlay. So in 1940, there was a researcher whose name was Dr. Adams, who discovered CBD in his lab. It was another quarter century until Dr. Raphael McCullum discovered THC. Dr. McCullum is a very famous cannabis researcher. He had a lab in Israel, again, was the first to discover THC, and then contributed to defining the endocannabinoid system and many of the functions of cannabinoids over his lifetime. Unfortunately, he died a year ago, but his contributions are paramount. In 1988, almost 25 years after THC was discovered, the very first receptor of the endocannabinoid system was discovered, and that is abbreviated CB1. CB1 is a G-coupled protein receptor. Not important that we know what kind of receptor it is, but it is important to understand, remarkably, that it has the most numerous receptor sites of any receptors in the entire central nervous system. So incredibly important. The distribution of those receptor sites are important. The receptor sites are in every one of the mammalian systems that we've studied. And what's unique in the human system is that there are very few of these receptor sites in the respiratory regulation sites of the brainstem. So we're going to talk a little bit about its parallel with the opioid system. But what it has going for it is it does not suppress respirations, and so is not nearly as dangerous as the opioids.
Let me interrupt you for a minute, because again, I want to make sure that our audience keeps up with this. And when we talk about receptor sites, let's define what we mean there. I sort of think of it as a lock and key kind of concept, but can you explain that a little more so people understand when we talk about CB receptors and so on, what those really are?
So receptors basically are sites of message sending, and these particular receptors, the CB1, and we'll also talk about a second one, a CB2, are called G-coupled proteins. And what they have going for them is they have different affinities for compounds on the outside of the cells versus the inside of the cell. So our bodies are mostly water, and so compounds get pushed through the vascular system, which is primarily water, come to a cellular surface. The cellular wall, as well as the interior of the cell, is lipid or fat-loving. And so I think anybody knows that's ever done cooking understands that water and oil don't mix. And so these receptors engage a compound. There is a transmission of that compound into the interior of the cell. And then there are electrical or chemical messages that are sent out from that interaction.
I think of it as almost a lock and key kind of concept, where there's locks on the cell membrane that are the receptors. When a substance that has an affinity for that receptor attaches, it unlocks, it acts as a key to unlock the receptor and allow something to happen. In the case of cannabinoids, that is a very important concept as it pertains to the cannabinoid receptors that are in all of our bodies that we didn't even know about till about 40 years ago.
Absolutely agree. The reason that there was cannabinoid research initiated by Dr. McCullum was to try to figure out how THC worked within the body. The subsequent discoveries after THC allowed us to identify both endocannabinoids, that is, cannabinoid-like structures that are produced by the body, endocannabinoid receptors that we just discussed, and then the third component of the system is an enzyme system, and the enzyme system helps to break down the endocannabinoids so that when their function is complete, they're not overshooting. It's a on-demand kind of system, and it's a very controlled system so that when balance is reestablished, homeostasis is reestablished, that the enzymes get rid of the endocannabinoids that have engaged the receptors, and we're back to normal again.
So Hal, let me understand. If I smoke a joint and I get THC in my bloodstream, what happens to it?
So the THC is a ligand, and I guess we're going to have to define what a ligand is, but it's the component that is able to engage the CB1 receptor site. It differs in chemical composition and structure from the endocannabinoids. And what's different about THC and endocannabinoids is the enzyme system that we just described doesn't work for THC. So THC gets into the bloodstream, it passes the blood-brain barrier, it engages a receptor site in the brain, and it's actually has more attraction, more affinity for the receptor CB1 than the endocannabinoids do. So it has a greater effect on that receptor site, and it doesn't get pushed off or destroyed the way that endocannabinoids are, so that it is more stimulating and it lasts longer. And that's the reason that there is a euphoria, a high, if you will, that exists for quite a time whenever THC engages the receptor site. The endocannabinoids don't give you that sort of euphoria or high because they are removed as soon as their job is done.
What's also incredible is that within all of our brains, with all the gazillion receptors there are for all the things that brains do, there are more CB1 receptors than any other type. Is that correct?
Yes.
So it's mind-boggling to think about it, that there's more potential for THC or another cannabinoid to affect the brain than almost anything else.
I think it speaks to the importance of the endocannabinoid system and the impact that it has on our overall health. And I think that's what's so exciting. It's what's gotten researchers excited about manipulating the endocannabinoid system to try to deal with some of the dysfunction, some of the diseases that we see, like chronic pain and chronic inflammation. I think this is probably a good place to stop, Les, with this introduction to the endocannabinoid system. And the next go around, we'll talk a little bit more about function and imbalance in the system and what we might be able to do in the future.
That sounds great, Hal. And as we've been doing on all these podcasts, we try to solicit and answer questions from our listeners. A question that we received has to do with the difference, the nuance between legalization and decriminalization of cannabis. And in future podcasts, we're going to take a very much deeper dive into all the legal ramifications of cannabis in this country now and how this is being handled at the state level. But to provide a simple overview to try to answer this question, some states have chosen to legalize cannabis. And when you legalize cannabis, they put guardrails around it. So it's not that you can walk around with a dump truck full of it or have it in the trunk of your car and go sell it to people. But in reasonable amounts for personal use, it is completely legal, just as it'd be legal to go buy a carton of milk or a six-pack of beer. In other states, they have chosen not to go that far, but rather to decriminalize. And what that means is it's not legal, but we're kind of slap your wrist and look the other way, and we're not going to impose any serious penalties on you for having, again, a guardrail amount of cannabis in your possession for personal use. So it's a subtle difference, but it is a difference. Different states have taken different paths to get to the approval process for cannabis. So I hope that gives some clarity. It's been good to be with you, Hal, and I'll see you next time. All information, material, and content on this podcast is for general information and educational purposes only and is not intended as a substitute for professional and/or medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment by a qualified physician or healthcare provider. No doctor-patient relationship is formed. The use of this information and any materials linked to this podcast is at the user's own risk. Cannabis House Call does not offer personal health or medical advice. If you have a medical emergency, call your doctor or call 911 immediately.